I'm James Watt, and this is Neuropod Podcast. Welcome, and I hope you enjoy the show. This is episode number one of what I hope are many podcasts to come. Neuropod is a weekly podcast focused on long-form interviews of people in and around the field of neurodiagnostics. I have an exciting lineup scheduled and hope to bring you interviews with some of the biggest names in the field, interviews with newer contributors to the field, and everyone in between. It has been exciting speaking with so many excellent guests. I hope that you find these interviews as enlightening, thought-provoking, entertaining, and educational as I have found them to be. If you like what you hear, please consider subscribing on YouTube, Spotify, or wherever you access your podcast content. Today, our guest is Lawrence Wierzbowski, a board-certified neurophysiologist and audiologist specializing in intraoperative neuromonitoring. In this episode, we get to explore Lawrence's journey from sound engineering to audiology. He discusses those, such as Rob Pratt, who had a significant influence on his early career. We talk about the importance of learning and knowing your craft well. And then we dive into the importance of simulation, the impact of AI on the field, and Lawrence's own foray into simulation and augmented reality. We talk about the early days of IOM, the birth of the ASNM webinar subcommittee, and many other topics. We hope you enjoy this conversation and come back next week for episode two of Neuropod Podcast. If there are any topics that you would like us to discuss, please email me at correspondence@neuropod.org. Well, welcome, Lawrence. And Lawrence, do you prefer to go by Lawrence or Larry?
For a long time, I've preferred Lawrence since I was a child, but people call me Larry, and so either one I'll answer to.
Okay.
I do prefer Lawrence, so call me Lawrence today.
All right, I'll call you Lawrence today. Well, welcome to the podcast. And so just tell the Neuropod community a little bit about yourself. Tell us, you know, about who Lawrence is professionally and who Lawrence is personally.
Now, that's a lot to bite off right at the start, but I'll give it a try. Okay, I'm Lawrence R. Wierzbowski, and how did I get my start in neurophysiology? A little history. I was a sound recording engineer and did live sound at the Hard Rock Cafe in Denver, Colorado for a while.
Interesting.
I did notice that people were losing their hearing, and so I became interested in that and read a book on audiology, Introduction to Audiology by Jerry Northern. And after reading that, I called up an audiologist in the Denver area and said, do you mind if I sit in on your sessions for a couple weeks? And so I did. And it was fascinating. She was diagnosing patients with hearing loss, fitting them with hearing aids, suspected retrocochlear in a few instances, which would be a tumor beyond the cochlea, as you know, like a an acoustic neuroma, and had those worked up with MRIs and all of that. And so after 2 weeks, you know, I fell in love with the science and called up a university in the area, Colorado State University, talked to Dr. Ackley and said, I don't have a background in hearing science, and I have my bachelor's in another degree, but can I apply for a master's? And he said, yeah, but you'll have to take all the bachelor's courses. And so that was my start. And as soon as I started audiology, I realized that my interest was in neural audiology.
Gotcha.
Not so much the hearing aids, although I enjoyed that. And it's perhaps because hearing aids are so difficult to fit. It's not like your eyeglasses. I put these on, I see absolutely perfect. Everything's in focus. The colors are there, the frequency and all of that. And so hearing aids are not like that, because most of the hearing population has a nerve hearing loss, which subsequently involves also the brainstem. Those type of hearing losses have so many complex variables to attend to that just a hearing aid, which tends to make sound louder or different frequencies louder, doesn't meet their needs, and it's an awfully hard. And so it can be very discouraging to a budding audiologist to try to fit a hearing aid, because patients really don't like them because they expect the same of hearing aids as their glasses. So from that background, I became interested in the auditory brainstem response. And what did I have? I had a Zenith computer. Zenith made TVs.
Okay, and all right.
Went out of business, and that's what they were known for, TVs in the 60s, I believe, and 70s. And so my Zenith computer didn't have a hard drive. It had big 5 1/4 inch floppy disk, and you had to put two of them in and jiggle them around to make sure they worked. But I started doing ABRs with that, and soon was able to get into the operating room, not for an operation, but to check a young 8-month-old who had suspected hearing loss, but was combative. Gotcha. And the EMTs couldn't make her sit still to look in her ears, and the audiologist had no luck at all in play or behavioral type audiology. So since my interest was in ABR, I was invited into the OR where they sedated the young baby, put her under, and I discovered my first hearing loss, a complete loss in the left ear from cytomegalovirus.
Hmm.
And with that, the child was able to go on and get hearing aids. And matter of fact, I took care of her for the first year of her hearing aid with all sorts of rehabilitation. So that's basically where I got my start. After a while in that practice, the owner, I'd like to thank him here, Dr. Robert Trainer, started using a facial nerve monitoring on a very limited scale.
Okay.
And so I got invited into the OR a few times to look at the facial nerve monitoring, and discovered that, okay, when data gets very noisy on this, I think it was a one-channel NIMS, or I can't remember the name of the unit, excuse me, but all of a sudden it was very noisy and the patient started moving. So that was my first experience in watch the EMG as well as the EEG. We didn't have EEG to determine loss. So
one channel facial nerve monitoring. So
yeah.
How did you set that up?
I think just the big Glarusaurus is what I
okay.
remember. It might not have been a NIMS. It could have been another early attempt at a machine. So I apologize, but that's all I can remember.
Gotcha,
and finally,
gotcha.
What prompted me into neurophysiology wasn't an invite by the neurosurgeon in the hospital in Colorado for an acoustic neuroma. And here I'm all confident. I've got my ABR and I've got my one channel facial nerve. And he asked me during the surgery how cranial nerve 9 was. I had no idea. It scared me. It scared me into seeking competence. And so I looked for a person in the literature who did intraoperative monitoring, was also a hearing scientist, and found Dr. Daniel Schwartz. And so I called him up and said, can I train with you? And he said, well, we could do a fellowship for a year. Come on out and we'll do an interview.
Nice.
And I found him in his garage, and he was playing with a Cadwell 5200A trying to repair it. And it was a weird situation because he had a couple of electrodes on his ulnar nerve. And I walk into his garage, and I see this very intense man. Those who know Dr. Schwartz know very intense, very acerbic, very knowledgeable, builds great teams, but has all these other things that are going on. And so I walk into the garage and I see his hand twitching, and he ignores you when you first walk in. So I'm standing there in the garage, and well, long story short, that's how I got my fellowship training. And that's the best way to do it, one-on-one for a year. Well, it wasn't all Dan, it was Rob Pratt, Surgical Monitoring Associates.
Okay.
Started by Dr. Schwartz, with help from his wife, Jamie, Then there was Rob Pratt. Not many people know Rob. I'm going to announce his name, Robert Pratt Jr. He is the most knowledgeable person I've ever met about intraoperative monitoring. He taught me just about everything I know at the very beginning of my career. Very strict, and the way he trained people was he didn't put up with any nonsense. And I encourage all of you out there who are just starting your career, and you might have great ideas, but maybe for the beginning, keep them to yourself for a while, because the person training you has a wealth of experience. So Rob would say, do this, do that, in this order. And, you know, I put aside my ego at that time. And it was a good thing I did, because I inherited his experience and made it my own. So nice. For those of you out there, give that a try.
Now, was all of your initial experience during your fellowship, was that cranial in nature, or were you also doing spinal monitoring, or what was the breadth of the experience that you got in your fellowship?
The fellowship was mainly at first cranial, and we're going to Hahnemann for the first time, Hahnemann University Hospital, and I gained the trust of the team. It was during my first week or so, because they were doing an acoustic neuroma. And I was looking at the data, and I could see that wave one was delayed instead of 1.56. It was like 2.4 or something like that. That's included. Well, that was including the adjustment for the tube.
Okay.
And five was also delayed by about the same amount, about whatever the millisecond was for wave one delay. And so I saw both wave and five were shifted, and I talked to Schwartz and I said, you know, that's a conductive looking loss. And he looked in the chart, and yes, the patient had
tympanal sclerosis,
which is a hardening of the tympanic membrane and would cause up to a 30 to 40 dB hearing loss in its more severe form. However, you asked, what did I do? Well,
yes, what did you do?
I did revision hips for the most of my first year, and I'll tell this story, and it was a wonderful experience. And I was too soon into it. That's the only thing I did by myself. And revision hips, and I'll tell you the story of why that happened. All the spine, the scoliosis, all the cranies, either Rob or Dan was with me, giving me guidance through those, and that's the way it should be for the first year at least.
Mm-hmm.
If you don't have someone in there with you for a long period of time, again, your knowledge isn't enough. You need experience to guide you in these situations, and we can talk more of that later. But what happened in the third month of my fellowship, that Rob Pratt, he's not a doctor, he's a master's degree, but I'll call him doctor. He had a case with this surgeon, and we were doing a revision hip, and we were doing it wrong, unbeknownst to us. We were borrowing a technique from the literature. And in that literature, well, there's your peroneal nerve right here, just distal to the fibular head, and in behind in the popliteal fossa is the tibial nerve. And what they were doing, remember, this is ancient machines, so don't be too judgmental, those out there who would say, hey, Wierzbowski, you're really dumb for doing that. But what they did was fibular head to tibial nerve, anode and cathode, all in the same leg. So they were stimulating both branches, and they thought, oh, this is great. We've got a good, strong signal that we could record from. And it was mostly cervical brainstem, because you have to remember, this was before TIVA. This is 1993. And, you know, during a revision hip, we recorded mainly from the cervical brainstem. So,
gotcha.
Two cases, both false negative. The patient woke up with foot drop.
That was what I was about to guess. Patients woke up with foot drop and was wondering why.
Yep. And the surgeon was mad and almost threw things. He was a big burly. I'm not going to say any names, but he's the big guy. He's 6'5" and looks like he's a linebacker for the Green Bay Packers rather than an orthopedic surgeon. Well, orthopedic surgeons, a lot of them are like that, aren't they? So
they can be.
Rob got mad at the surgeon after being yelled at for about 15 minutes and said, "I refuse to work with you." Well, there were just three of us, and Dan didn't want to do the revision hips. So he came up to me and said, "Figure it out." And so an important lesson was learned from the literature. And if you have, I encourage all of you, you're going to have a bad case someday. Maybe your second year, third year, first year, whenever. The thing to do is to do a failure analysis. Go over all the data. See what went wrong. And, you know, I looked at the data. And the data looked good. There were some changes in the aptitude of the SSEP, but not a lot. It wasn't 50%. It wasn't even 40% or 30%. But then you look at the literature, and I recommend looking at complications. Find your surgery, find the complications. And so I read the complications, and what were they? Well, for severe complications, both the tibial and peroneal, but for mild, it was just peroneal. For moderate, it was just peroneal, but for all of the cases, every single one in the reported literature, peroneal was involved. Yeah. So the key here was focus on the peroneal nerve. So all we did was stimulate the peroneal nerve behind the fibular head. And about 2 months later, we did have another alert where there was some foot drop, but they recovered and the data caught it. Nice. So that was my lesson in my first year of how to research things when they go wrong. And I encourage all of you to do it. If you're a technologist in your second year, it doesn't matter. You could read the literature. You can look these things up. Knowledge is so free now. I mean, it was really hard. You'd have to go to the library back in 1993, like I did, and look things up on the library shelves. But now
it's at your fingertips.
Yeah, PubMed. Yep. It's so easy. So you have all this. So anywhere from, you know, world famous neurologists to DABNM to BCSIONM to first year technologist, you can do this, and it's well worth your while if things go wrong. It actually saved my career. Nice. I was ready to quit. Can you imagine your third month and two false negatives? It was like, this is, for lack of a better word, bull stuff. And you know, you have these wonderful tools, and make use of them.
And I agree. So instead of quitting, you dug in, you figured out what the problem was, and you made modifications to make sure that you could catch the expected issues. So did you monitor tibial nerve and peroneal nerve, or was your equipment at the time too limited to be able to do both, or how did you handle that?
It was a Cadwell 5200A that we were using. We had a Viking also. The group had two Cadwell 5200As and a Viking. The Cadwell 5200As did have two stimulators, a left and a right. And so instead of monitoring the other leg, which never proved useful in that type of case, I did use the tibial and the peroneal nerve and monitor both divisions.
And did you ultimately start monitoring then the lumbar potential, or did you primarily monitor the cervical brainstem potential for those procedures?
At the start, maybe for the first year, James, it was all the cervical brainstem because that's what I knew. But I read HP. Gotcha. You know HP called.
Yeah, right? I do. Yes.
And in ASNM Monitor, 1994, he wrote a wonderful article on monitoring the peroneal nerve, and I paid attention. And I, you know, experimented around it. And I did it wrong at first. You know, I was putting all my electrodes for the lumbar potential on the back. And you're not supposed to do that. Your reference should be on the hip or some other place far away. And once I learned that, then I started monitoring the lumbar potential. And that was also useful. And during that period of time, things were changing with anesthesia, and we were starting to win the battle of TEVA, even back then, 1994-ish, 95, by then we had it. So propofol was very expensive, and it was also still in protected mode. What is it? When you have a patent, you have a certain amount of time that the patent's in force. And AstraZeneca was the holder of that patent. And because of that, propofol was expensive. And, you know, they had to cover their clinical trials and other research type of costs. So more power to them. But because of the expense, it was very difficult to convince anesthesia to change to propofol and narcotic. But we immediately saw the benefits of that for both the cortical. That was one of my first papers was a comparison of, it was nitrous rather than, desfluorine and that, but we were looking at, it was desfluorine and nitrous compared to TEVA for a cortical response. And that's, I forget the name of the paper, but it's one of the first papers I contributed to in SMA.
Very nice. So talking about anesthesia, I'm always interested in hearing, the thoughts of people that have been in the field for years, knowing that anesthetic control or modification for our monitoring is so important. I'm always interested to hear, the approaches that people take in, conversing with the anesthesiologist, convincing them of the necessity and of the benefit, of using TEVA or other modified anesthetic for the neuromonitoring. So what have you found to be successful in communicating with anesthesiologists to convince them that TEVA is something that we, need?
Well, going into the OR, either to a surgeon or to an anesthesiologist and demanding is counterproductive. They're the expert, and they would take offense at that. The best thing that we did was to give lectures to the anesthesiologist. We would go to Children's Hospital, Pennsylvania, and they would have a day where, they were reviewing cases and doing rounds and all that sort of stuff. And we would give talks to them, and we would give examples, data examples. And to follow up on that, we would include them in the conversation, in the interpretation sometimes. Come on over, look at this. You've just turned the gas on at the end of this scoliosis case. Look at this data. You can see that right. It's the waveform being, 1.5, it's now 0.7. You can see the data's halved. So including them within the decision-making, and sometimes you can even fool them by asking, what's the best regimen for obtaining evoke potentials? And, if they read the literature, they'll know that it's usually TEVA, and that other forms will have detrimental effects. One of the arguments I hear that I really don't agree on is that, okay, especially during scoliosis, we have a fully normal kid. We're going to get good responses on him, right? Right. But what happens? Well, the argument is if the child has neural compromise, then we would change to TEVA. But the whole purpose of scoliosis, especially idiopathic, is to protect the spinal cord. Mm-hmm. And during the distraction derotation, as you're stretching out the spinal cord, and Leo Happel would tell you that oftentimes during the stretch that the not the anterior artery so much, but the little sulcal arteries, the little penetrators that go in. Those are the ones that get stretched and cut off. And once you reach the sulcal artery, there are no collateral flow anymore. You're there. And that's the reason sometimes there's just one-sided. Sometimes the sulcal arteries get stretched on one side. You know, scoliosis is more stretched on one side than the other. And so when that happens, you want to be optimized then. And scoliosis, there's enough, you know, one out of 100 or whatever. There are enough events that even if you have a perfectly normal child, it's really best to be optimized at the very beginning to deal with that. Otherwise, you're going to make an incorrect decision. What do I mean by that? Well, one of the great predictors of things happening is the reversal of our signals after they change. Okay, we lose all our signals. We're like, oh, my God. You know, stop, Mr. Surgeon, Miss Surgeon. We take a look at this data. We have lost our motors. We have lost our sensories. I'm very concerned about the cord. And so things stop. And, you know, all of a sudden, 5 minutes later, depending on the mechanism of injury to the spinal cord injury, and I heard that Stan Skinner is going to give a talk on this perhaps in ASNM in the future, so I'm very much looking for his talk in the future. But depending on the mechanism of injury to the spinal cord, you know, if our signals can come back in a certain amount of time and a certain amount of degree, then it's wise to not take out the instrumentation. It's wise to continue on the surgery. However, if our signals remain ablated and gone for a longer period of time, then maybe it's time for them to decide, let's take out the instrumentation. So why am I saying all this? If you have the confounding factor of inhalational agent, and you know, during the alert, they're probably changing that. Up and down, down and up to control the blood pressure, because things happen. If there's a spinal cord injury, pressure can change up and down and other factors. So they're not going to be steady state usually during that period of time. So if because of the anesthesia, we can't see that the cord's returning, maybe it's just a mild contusion and potassium is released and that's reabsorbed and that the signals come back. We might come out with a really kind of like a false positive because of the anesthesia. These are just optimal things I'm talking about. And I realize fully that there are situations where you cannot change and you have to work with, you know, the people you work with, and you have to go with what the best decision of the whole team is. And you're part of that, but you're not the captain of the ship. Never will be.
Yeah, I fully agree. I have found recently, you know, a lot of success in conversing with anesthesiologists, and especially if we're doing transcranial motor evoked potentials, which is usually when we want TEVA, of presenting it as a patient safety issue. I have, you know, we don't know what the voltage is doing. I mean, if it's activating the motor cortex and it's activating the sensory cortex and who knows what else it's activating, you know, that potentially creates, you know, a patient safety issue that, you know, they will have issues following surgery that we don't know what those issues are. I mean, in addition to just potential, you know, tongue lip lacerations where we have elevated thresholds, you know, in order to obtain MEPs when, we're using inhalational agents.
So inhalation agents would raise the threshold.
Right.
That's perfect reasoning. I'll have to remember. That's a great tip. Thank you, James.
Yeah, no problem. When you present it that way to anesthesiologists, and then also the other thing that I've found helpful is offering to give them guidance on depth of anesthesia based upon EEG. Some of them seem to really, you know, appreciate that and, you know, are willing to give you TEVA where they might not otherwise. So,
yeah, that's a powerful weapon, the depth of anesthesia. In my experience, I'm not an EEG guy. I know it, but you know, I don't do diagnostic EEG. But my difficulty with the EEG is that I can tell if they're deep enough. I can tell, you know, if once I see the beginning of birth suppression, I know their BIS is 30 or less. It's the other end. If anesthesia is asking me, is the patient waking up? That is very hard for me to determine. Do you have any success or tips for how to do that?
Yeah, I mean, I prefer to watch. So I always look at the raw EEG, but I also prefer to have processed EEG on the screen. And the reason for that is that if the patient is starting to get light, one of the things that you'll notice is that we will change from this widespread alpha rhythm to a little bit higher frequency, more of a beta type rhythm.
Sure.
And so if I start to see that, and then if I start to see that in addition to maybe some EMG activity, you know, from my SSCP leads, those two things together, you know, give me a pretty good indicator that that patient is starting to get light. But yeah, I seem to be able to use the process EEG to pick up that that beta activity a little easier than you know, if I'm looking at the raw data.
Yeah, I've used the density spectral array for years for exactly that purpose. The other thing that EMG is a powerful weapon, of course, but by that time it's a little too late. If they're moving, right, everybody knows. One other thing on the SSCP, if you're using TEVA, there's, I think Dan called it his Schwartz wave. So
Schwartz wave.
You know, you've got your primary peak, right?
Mm-hmm.
The SSCP, and there it is. And on your PTN SSCP, if you start to see a secondary peak, what is that? Well, theorization is that that is the connections going to the association cortex,
mm-hmm,
to process that stimulus that's reaching the brain. And then eventually, you know, if I was to do an SSCP on you right now, there'd be three peaks.
Mm-hmm.
So I often use that kind of as an adjunct to EEG to help determine the depth of anesthesia. So SSCP, besides all the other armamentarium that we have, can be very useful as a backup, as a confirmation. As we know with multimodality, one modality can lead us into false pathways. So it's best to have a couple things to help confirm. And it's a much better argument. Oh my goodness, we got some EMG, we got beta on our EEG, and look, the SSCP, I see three peaks. Dear anesthesia, I think we're getting light. I'm concerned about the patient. And they'll respond.
I completely agree. I love using the late waves or the Schwartz waves to determine depth of anesthesia. All right. So I have changing gears just a little bit. So you've been in the field for a long time. And during your career, during your lifetime, what is the accomplishment of which you are the most proud?
Oh, boy. Well, contributing to a society, I think, by maybe the webinars, the ASNM webinars, which you were a part of the foundation of that also. But it was very hard to find people who would talk to you. So now with the webinars, there's a library, an encyclopedic library of world experts, including you.
Thank you.
And, you know, Stanley Skinner and all sorts of luminaries talking about what to do for this monitoring modality in this situation. What's the anatomy of the spinal cord? What should you do if you want to do a localization of the spinal cord? Where's the motor part of the spinal cord? Where's the sensory? You know, if you're doing a tumor and want to approach the spinal cord successfully. So now with the ASNM webinars, and other societies have webinars too, but you know, I wasn't a part of those, so ASNM at least, now we have an encyclopedic, and it's free. Free to members. And so I'm very proud of helping to launch that. And I'm proud of my person that I help mentor to follow me, Patty Worf. She's taken the baton.
She does a great job.
Much faster and much better than I ever did at the beginning of our webinar series. And so I am very proud of that. That's one of my best achievements, is to have an educational tool for everybody. That's if you're an ASNM member, it's free. If not, you pay some fee. I don't even know what it is, but it's there for everybody.
I agree, Lawrence. I think the webinars are a wonderful thing that you have been able to help ASNM provide. Talk to me about, you know, because they are free to members, and most societies do not make webinars free, you know, to their members. So talk to me about how that, you know, line of thinking came about, and talk to me about, you know, was there difficulty in kind of convincing ASNM that this would be a good thing versus, you know, charging for the webinars?
Yeah, well, there was resistance to the webinars. And, you know, back when we were doing that, that's over 10 years now. Webinars weren't a thing. There was worry by certain board members that it would take people away from our annual meeting and other meetings. And so they thought, well, people will go to that instead of the live meetings, and we'll start losing money. And money was a factor for ASNM webinars. It was a huge expense at first. It's much better now. They have the cost down, and they've been able to work on individual things. But at the start, each webinar cost almost $4,000. And I lost sleep over this $4,000 hurdle that we had to go through. We had to pay the management company. We had to pay the people who provided the software. We had a small honorarium for the speaker. But at the end of the day, with insurance and everything else, it was close to $4,000. So how could we offer a webinar if 25 people showed up and it cost $4,000? Well, $4,000 divided by 25 is a lot of money to charge for a webinar. So the committee and I got together and we brainstormed and came up with the idea, if we just raise the membership cost a little bit. So that's what we did. We spread it out over the entire membership, and that is the reason they're free. They're not exactly free, since everybody pays a little bit more for their membership compared to what they used to, but the benefits are so immense. It's very exciting. So that's how that became into a reality for ASNM. I think my best moment was the person who was most against the webinars, when that idea came up, embraced that and actually increased the charge that we were going to cost, members by $5, I think. And since that happened, webinars are now available to all ASNM members for the entire webinar. And if you do watch a webinar, just remember that you can go back in history and watch the first one by Harvey Edmonds, the second one by Leo Happel, the third one by Brett Netherton, and on and on and on until the very latest one. And it's like getting a college education for free in IONM. It really is.
Very, very useful information. I agree. I think the webinars are one of the best things that members get as a part of their membership. I think, I've heard a lot of individuals say that they joined ASNM specifically because of the webinars and the access that they had to the webinars. So, great job with that, Lawrence. And I agree,
great Patty. Reviewing anatomy and that, tips for how to prepare for your certification type things, as well as Kent Rice for the other type of certification. So congratulations to you too.
Well, thank you. And thanks. And Patty, she does a great job. So she is, I know this year there's some very good webinars that are in the planning, and always bring top-notch people in. So, and always seem to have some cutting-edge topics that are being discussed, like, laryngeal adductor reflex monitoring, things of that nature. So talk to me about your favorite part of the field. You've been in the field for a while. You've seen it evolve. What is your favorite, what is your favorite maybe modality to monitor or direction that you see that the field is moving? I'm not sure if I'm clear with my question there, but.
That's all right. It's a broad field. It's hard to narrow it down to one thing or another. I'm not sure about my favorite modality. Well, probably motors.
Okay.
Because like so many of us, there was a bad event in my first year at a children's hospital, and I felt like I let everybody in the world down. This was a scoliosis case, a kyphoscoliosis case. And, those are more risk. I think it's a 30% risk of change during a kyphal scoliosis case.
Right.
And I was monitoring SSEPs. That's what we had, 1994. I had SSEPs and EMG. And my SSEPs didn't change. And this kid woke up weak. And the surgeon was disappointed. I was disappointed. I didn't want to go back. Dan forced me to go back the next day.
That's probably a good thing.
Yeah, it was a hard thing. And so a year after that, in 1995, that's about right, we started to look into motors. And I can remember our first motor. We did it on a Viking. So Tony Sestokas was charged with doing it. I think Rob Pratt. And I was there also. And they were doing it with the Viking. We didn't have a Digitimer or anything.
Okay.
It was pre-Digitimer. And, we got from the Netherlands, there was a circumferential type, 8 electrodes.
Okay.
And one return electrode at CZ. And so we had read how to do that. So we put the electrodes on, and then we had to get it into the stimulator, which only has a positive and a negative. And so, I got out my linkers, and everybody got out their linkers, and we linked them all together. And we got the motor, but the patient just about jumped off the table. This will never
imagine.
Work. But we got the motor. This will never work. I said, we're doing a cervical case, and, it's going to cause an injury. But the circumferential was the first motor evoked potential. And then I built electronics is in my background too. And it was simple, a simple thing where you plug in all the electrodes into one box and it just serially connects them all together.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
So you have an anode and a cathode and you don't have to worry. And then once we got the Digitimer, I also built a phase reversal, a two-pole double throw type of switch, you might be
okay.
Aware of that. Mm-hmm. So you just flip the switch and the polarity switch. And so that was very useful. Otherwise, you'd have to unplug and plug back in.
Right,
so,
right.
So those were wonderful times. And so I don't recommend making equipment by anybody. Back then, the standards, you just went to bio Biomed and said, here, would you approve them? And they did. I wouldn't, the liability is so great now, I wouldn't recommend anybody making their own equipment without going through, you know, all the approval process by the government and all of that. It's just too risky now with the...
Those were the days, though. The wild, wild west of neuromonitoring. I remember we would be building cables and boxes to do, you know, we would switch between EMG and SSEPs with little flip switches with our Quantum 84. And then,
build boxes for dermatomes. I did that also.
Yep. And we built our own Cottonwick electrodes and used them in the OR. And I don't recommend doing that today.
So. Cotton's one of the worst things you can leave inside the brain cell,
yes.
By the way. So don't be careful when you use cotton. Read that in some paper.
You're not speaking from experience then. That's good.
No.
You have, as of recent years, you've been involved in some immersive training in the form of virtual reality and simulation. So much so that you've developed a product that you call Avitrode. So talk to us about Avitrode, and also talk to us about the benefits that you see of, you know, immersive simulation training, and also some of the drawbacks that you see from that particular training.
So why did I start this? Back when we were trying to figure out who does what and what you're entitled to do with your certification. And so we had a summit. I'll give credit. Bernie Cohen came up with this idea. There's another Mike and Jack Hastings. Jack Hastings, mm-hmm. a neurologist. He's no longer with us, but he was also a president of ASNM. And so we put together a summit where we had outside experts look at our field and give us their opinion. One was a lawyer, and boy, he cut us a new one, saying, you know, all the different people doing this and what your titles are, and you don't have standards and blah, 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 blah. So it was very useful to hear the lawyer part. One was from a government, and they were giving information about insurance and all of that. And the third one was a guy named Rick Sataba. Do you know the name, James?
I do.
Okay. Rick Sataba is a scientist. He worked for DARPA at the time, which is the military arm of research. He was working on robots that go into the field, gather up wounded soldiers and put them in the container. You know, he's cutting edge technology. But he was also one of the inventors of the Da Vinci robot. Hmm. And one of his themes during his talk was, our weakness in neurophysiology is that we practice on the patient.
Mm-hmm.
You know, a new technologist comes in and they're practicing on the patient. That's the first thing they do. They set up a patient. You know, they might, you know, have a little head to practice the 10-20 system. But in reality, we're practicing on patients. And he thought that was dangerous. And he thought that was a poor way to learn. Here's some of the reasons he gave for it, a poor way to learn. Incidents of bad things happening. I can do 1,000 cases, and I can be monitoring Herb's point, and nothing happens. Let's say I'm doing an ACF, and I monitor Herb's point for whatever reason, and I can do 1,000 cases, and patient wakes up fine. But the one time the patient needs us, you know, we're doing something wrong. And so that is one of the reasons that he suggested simulation, was that because of this low incidence, it takes us forever to see an actual case where things go wrong. Exceptions to that, of course, if you have a spinal cord tumor, you expect, you know, changes in your motors, For kyphal scoliosis, maybe there's a 30%, but for the majority of cases, we can do 1, 5, 10, 100, 1,000, and no one knows of our inability to really monitor this. Unlike a musician, I'm a musician too, that's part of my background. As a musician, if I didn't practice and I went up on stage and I wasn't prepared, everybody in the audience knew. But in the OR, if you're not prepared, you can be there and not everybody knows neurophysiologists, the anesthesiologists, right, right. The nurses, and the surgeons many times are ignorant of what our waveforms mean. And so simulation is a way to practice. But it's important, I think, that we understand that our field needs to up our competence. And one of the ways is by simulation, because when we simulate something, we can create a problem in a short period of time, and we can practice it, and we can vary it. When we're in the OR, if we make decision A, maybe the patient's paralyzed. If we make decision A but change it to B and have two other things, we could have maybe a patient in pain but not paralyzed. Mm-hmm. So there's a whole spectrum of decision-making things and things that we can do that we can practice prior to being in the OR. So just imagine this matrix tree and all the whole spectrum of patient outcome based on our ability to monitor. That's both for the technologist and for the interpreting professional, whoever they be, to take into consideration all these factors that we possibly can meet, practice them, learn from our mistakes, and in simulation, our mistakes, they're for free. We can make a mistake. Right. We can make a mistake and nothing happens. There's no consequence to a patient. So that's how the interest in simulation came. And then I started to explore different platforms. I looked at Meta, I looked at Second Life, I looked at some others, commercial ones. And the one I have, my main one is, well, you can set it up and people could actually for free use this platform. I'm not going to say what it is because I haven't released it yet. Once inside, you know, there's the benefit of other education, simulation, game theory. Game theory is a popular way to learn. And, I don't have children, and I don't think you do either, but anybody who has a child sees their children sitting in front of the computer playing a computer game. And each computer game has rewards for the participant, keeps track of what the participant is doing, varies the difficulty of the task, and it is constant feedback, constant doing, constant, you know, it could be anything from like missed solving puzzles or some crazy shoot game, but either one still is very useful in that they use game theory to make sure that they have the attention of their audience. Our lectures are fine. Our webinars are fine. Seminars are fine. But I think simulation needs to be done also for our profession to give us a three-legged type of educational stability where simulation can fill in the gaps of knowledge. Where, you know, we hear Stan Skinner say, monitoring below the belt. Oh, that sounds good. But where do we find the genital femoral? Oh, I got to put an electrode there. Well, if you could somehow practice that, not on a live patient, but in simulation, that would be a benefit. And I apologize to everybody. I get off on on my platform and I get on my little box to lecture. I hope I'm not the only one. I have some evidence that a few other people are interested. And there needs to be several forms of virtual reality too. Virtual reality where you're two-dimensional, virtual reality where you're three-dimensional. And perhaps one of the most powerful is augmented reality, which I have very limited experience, but I see great things for that. Some guys from Slovenia, I went off to Bangkok and gave a lecture on simulation, and I met some guys from Slovenia that were doing augmented reality. And they had a simple augmented reality, but it was so powerful. What they did was they simulated a person going into anaphylactic shock. So you put on the goggles, and instead of the auditorium I was in, it turned into the auditorium was still there, but also an emergency room was there with a patient, a young female patient, who was in distress, in great distress, in describing her symptoms. You know, I'm starting to have trouble breathing. I have these hives on my arm. They're going up and down, and they're spreading. And my task was simple: to find something to help her, to understand what's going on, which I did pretty quick. Within 20 seconds, I said, anaphylactic shock. So I'm patting myself on the back. But I, rummaging through drawers and stuff, I didn't find the EpiPen. And she started gasping, and she died.
Oh, no.
And it still affects me.
Huh.
I'm getting emotional reaction. So my criteria for an effective simulation is, does it affect you emotionally as well as intellectually? Because as you know, in the OR, when things go bad, it's not just
right.
Paper A, this paper B says this, and you know, we do A, B, C, and D. You know, that's all well and good. That's all part of it. But at the same time, the surgeon's panicking. Part of our job is to protect the surgeon and to support the surgeon also during those periods of time. And so having that is a simulation with high fidelity. That's the word I'm trying to get. Your simulations, you said, what are some of the disadvantages? Trying to obtain that high fidelity, the high quality, where you're not just an intellectual exercise, but also it affects the limbic system and everything else, and maybe gives you even motor skills to deal with some of the things that you're dealing with.
Hmm.
All those take a long time to figure out. And the big disadvantage of simulation, at least now, perhaps that will change a little bit with the advent of artificial intelligence and, you know, ChatGPT. But to give you an example, I was having trouble writing code to have a simple thing, a door open to make a creaking sound and to close after 10 seconds. I was writing code for that. I kept making mistakes, and I asked ChatGPT to do it for me. And it made lots of mistakes too. But in the end, it came up with a solution. So it saved me days and days and days. So with respect to artificial intelligence, people are worried about that taking their job. Well, I think people will lose their jobs. The ones who don't accept artificial intelligence and don't use it will lose their jobs. Those that embrace it and start to use it as an appropriate tool, they're the ones who will survive in our profession. So maybe that's a hypothesis, and I apologize if I'm stepping out of my lane, but those are my thoughts. And that's
I'm glad that you brought up AI, because I've seen your simulation, at least parts of the simulation that you've developed. And it looks like, and I know talking to you, that it takes a lot of time and a lot of effort to put that together. And so do you see that AI is going to significantly decrease the amount of time that it takes for you to put some of that stuff together so that you can develop it more quickly?
Especially the coding. I'm not a brilliant coder, for sure. You know, I didn't learn that till 10 years. It's wonderful, actually, like learning piano, you keep sharp. I'm in my 70s, and like any 70-year-old, I'm worried about my cognition. But I think one of the ways to stave off cognitive decline is to build new pathways by learning new things. So coding and doing other, you know, programs. I think the best thing you could do is to take several different programs and mesh them together, like Adobe Audio, combining that with Adobe PowerPoint and all of that, and getting several programs to work together to come up with a better product. And that's one way, and you create, just like in your brain, new pathways by using different programs to work together with each other. And that's one of the reasons it's fun to do creative modeling and simulation in Avitrode.
So when will we see Avitrode out in the wild for new neuromonitoring technologists to begin using and learning?
That's a hard question. I could do it now, but it'd be unsatisfying. So I'm hoping within at least 2 years or 1 year. It depends on several factors. One is economics. I have this business, and I do some remote consultation, some expert witness, and I use all of those funds. They don't go to, you know, Wurzbowski's car fund or something. They go to Avitrode. I do have some investments that will mature, perhaps, be either go or bad this month. And so depending on the state of those investments, if they go good, then I'll start hiring people to help me with this. So, you know, economics in any profession plays a profession. I did go with the government grants once, and I wrote up a SBIR grant, and by the time I got it done, they canceled the program. So it was very discouraging. And they also have a lot of strings attached. And so the government grants, it's a double-edged sword. You have to do all the things that they want you to do, even if you disagree with them. So it might be better to finance it by myself rather than go down the government path.
Gotcha. Well, I hope that your investments go well in the next month here so that you can bring Avitrode to the neurodiagnostic world. I think that it's sorely needed, and I agree. I've looked into augmented reality. I've looked into virtual reality and simulation, and I agree. I think being able to see things that you may not be able to see in, you know, 2 years of doing neuromonitoring, and being able to see it repeated so that you can make different choices and see what that does to the patient. Because, I mean, in the reality is we have a patient that is depending on us. And so we owe it to our patients to know how to make good decisions. And part of that is seeing things over and over and over again until you have seen the minute differences and changes and things, and what reactions, you know, you make to that data. You know, how that can improve the outcome for our patients.
As a preeminent educator yourself, you understand that. You know, encouragement to all of you out there, all you new neurologists, all you new technologists, all you new audiologists, DABNMs, whatever your field. And part of the strength of our field is that we're so diverse that we form a really strong background knowledge. But look in the mirror. What is the best chance of the patient having normal neural function during complex spine, brain, spinal cord surgery? It's you. The neural in your name, you might be called a clinical or a surgical neurophysiologist, a neurologist, whatever. For neural, you are the expert in the room. And oftentimes, I think we don't feel equal, but when it comes to certain times and certain events, we are. We should take ownership of our profession. It's coming to that. But I know we have a long way to go, both ASSET, ASNM, ACNS, all of those are such hopeful. And I'm going to take this opportunity to thank ASNM, ASSET, ACNS. You know, I felt so alone. In 1993, I went to the neurologist. Remember that case I talked to you about? The one I lost, it was an anterior artery syndrome. Had kyphoscoliosis. I don't think I said anterior artery, but that's what it was. The SSPs didn't change. The motors changed. It was some sort of either sulcal artery or anterior artery type of syndrome. So a couple of weeks later, I went to the neurologist at this children's hospital, and I said, please help me understand what's going on. Can you help me? And they said, monitoring smoke and mirrors, we're not interested. So we've come a long way from, you know, medicine ignoring us to embracing us. So I think our profession has come a long, long way. And we should be proud of ourselves for doing that. So, well, I've lost my train of thought. I better go back and learn a new cognitive skill.
Oh, that's funny. Well, so you started to address this. You did a little bit, but what if someone was just coming into the field today, and learning this, with no exposure to neuromonitoring, prior to today, what is some advice that you would give to that technologist or that clinician, as they are learning the field and as they're trying to, master the field?
Read at first. The shoulders of giants is an expression, but it's true. So here, you had asked about some books. So that's backwards on here, but it says Neuromonitoring, the Prevention of Intraoperative Injury by Steven Saltzman. So one of the first books I read on intraoperative monitoring. And from that, I learned intracellular potassium during a spinal cord contusion is released. And if it's a mild contusion, will be reabsorbed and we get our signals back. So it gave me an understanding early on of how to manage a case. And this was before, it was the practice of medicine and all that. And so understanding that, I was able to help surgeons understand, they'd put in a hook or something, a sublaminar hook, common, and that goes under the lamina and that could impact one half of the cord. And oftentimes we'd lose somatosensory evoked potentials or motor potentials on that side and they would spread to the other. And helping the surgeon to understand that this was a contusion type of event and that things were coming back was very reassuring to them. And without that knowledge, if the interpreter is just saying, oh, the signals are back, we don't know why. Jeffrey Balzer is a wonderful person, and he's of the opinion that for every change, you should really know what's happening and why that change happened. And I believe that too. It's not always possible. I'm not smart enough to do it every time, but by reading people like Steve Saltzman, he gained his knowledge in experimental neurophysiology. One of the first to do contusion studies on rats by dropping a certain weight from a certain height and measuring the intracellular and extracellular potassium. What a brain. And unfortunately, he lost his research job and he came to SMA and I was teaching this genius how to do intraoperative monitoring. And sometimes a genius lab person, PhD, might not be the best person in the OR. They get very distracted and they don't put the same importance on where to put the PT. And I'd walk into the room and it'd be on the lateral side of the ankle instead of the medial for the PTN. And I'd look at poor Steve and he'd have paste all over his whole body. And so, bless him, he had such a knowledge of intraoperative monitoring of the neural anatomy, the neurophysiology. But sometimes the best and brightest in that type of field might not make the best clinicians. And so as practice managers, I urge all of you to look at your people's talents and put them in appropriate places. Sometimes a person that, you know, is a brilliant person really doesn't belong in the OR for certain reasons. And so you need to look at their particular talents. Handbook of Spinal Cord, Anatomy. You said how to be successful.
Hold it up just a little bit higher so we can.
Then okay. Backwards.
It's forward on this side.
Oh, is it? Okay. Mm-hmm. It's backwards on mine. So there you can see. That's one of my favorite books. You prompted me to look for my favorite book. So if you are going to do spinal cord monitoring or interpreting, the more you know, the drink deep from the well, and you'll avoid making trivial mistakes. And so if you have an understanding of spinal cord perfusion, you know, James, I've been an expert witness a few times now in court, and what I see really bears this in mind. I've witnessed, without saying any names or locations, an example of this. A scoliosis case. The first rod is put in, derotation correction. The neurophysiologist in the room goes out for a 40-minute break. Hmm. Why? I've always done that. Remember the lecture before where I was saying we can get away with things? This was a person who got away with things, tradition or whatever. Someone said to him, well, it's okay, most of the distraction is done, but it's not. Right. And so by, you know, just understanding at any level, it'll give you an understanding of perhaps what to do. So I was going to say, if you're interested in hearing the basis of hearing science, this is a wonderful book and will help you to understand some of the things. And, you know, Neural Otology by Jackler, you'll find one of my mentors, Chuck Yingling, in there with facial nerve and all of that. And what's the other one I was going to talk about? Oh, Principles of Neuroscience. I can't even lift it. It's so big. Kendall and Schwartz. Read tomes like that. And it will help you to communicate with the surgical team. Now, for heaven's sake, though, don't go up to them and get too technical. So if you have a loss of motors, you don't get up and say, I think the sulcal artery penetrator is in vasospasm. You don't say that to an orthopedic surgeon. You have to speak in the same language in that. But if you know what's going on, you can help guide in a more subtle manner than you know, this academic type of stuff.
I agree. We owe it to all of our patients to study and read and know the anatomy, know what type of injuries we may see, and you know, how those can be resolved or how they may resolve themselves, so that we can communicate to the surgeons appropriately.
As well as the readers, they're off in the dark, aren't they? The MDs, the neurologist, whatever type of interpreting professionals out there, they can use some guidance too. And if you say, well, especially the contextual, like they just put in a sublaminar hook and, you know, it might have contused the cord, something like that will get them off on the right pathway, other than just seeing, oh, the potentials are gone. And so context is very helpful. How about yourself as a technologist? Why do you think all this extra knowledge might be helpful?
Well, I think extra knowledge, the more that we know about the neurophysiology, the more that we know about the potential issues that our patients may experience, I think I think Jack Cartouche may have said this one time. Actually, he said two things that I think are kind of appropriate here. The first thing is, you know, poor monitoring is worse than no monitoring at all. And so knowing the anatomy, knowing the neurophysiology, knowing how to obtain data appropriately, how to troubleshoot, resolve noise issues, that gives us the ability to provide good monitoring for those patients. But also, you know, Jack, the other thing that he, I believe it was him, I'm going to credit him anyhow, is that, you know, the difference between a, just a so-so surgeon, he was using it in the context of a surgeon, and I'll use it in the context of a neurophysiologist, but the difference between a so-so surgeon and an excellent surgeon is that the excellent surgeon not only prepares for the actual procedure, but prepares for all of the potential outcomes that that procedure could have, all of the potential mistakes or the potential issues that could arise during the surgery. And they have prepared appropriate responses so that they don't panic during those issues. And so I think, likewise, as neurophysiologists, you know, if we know the things that can go wrong, and we prepare for the things that can go wrong by reading, studying, asking questions, and really, you know, knowing the neurophysiology, I think we can deliver much better care to our patients and much better outcomes with that care.
Oh, I agree. I agree so much with that. That is a wonderful way of telling that. And as an adjunct, remember back to your beginning days in the OR?
Long time ago.
It was frightening. You didn't know what a 4x4 would do. You didn't know why they're intubating, what you should do, if you know when to put these electrodes on. And so as you gain more knowledge about anatomy, neurophysiology, about the surgical procedure, that's another avenue that I haven't mentioned, but learning the steps of the surgery, and they vary a little bit by surgeon, mm-hmm. by surgeon. By becoming familiar with that, the level of stress in your life will diminish, diminish, mm-hmm. diminish, diminish, even during the crisis periods. So if you can maintain a calm head, you really help the patient, surgeon, and the entire surgical team deal with a very difficult, what's worse than, God, motors are gone. The surgeon sees their life flashing in front of their eyes. Yep. Anesthesia's thinking, oh, the legal team's going to be calling me, so I better make notes and all of that. So, yeah, just like you said, all the options really makes a good surgeon or neurophysiologist or a good medical professional. So thanks for that.
Yeah, no, thank you. All right, so we're coming into the home stretch here. I've kept you for quite a bit of time now. But as we wrap up, I want to ask you, who are the three people in your life that have had the most significant impact on you? You know, and in the notes that I sent you, one professional, one personal, and then the third can be either.
Okay. Well, I got to be number one is Joy Wierzbowski. Who else would put up with this mug for 47 almost 48
years? She keeps you in straight.
Yeah, you've met her. She's a delight. She has supported me. I mean, when I was, remember, I was changing professions. I've gone from a teacher to a sound engineer to a factory worker for a while in a window blind factory, off to master's. Well, she was the one supporting me. She financially and mentally to get
nice.
Through that.
Yep.
When I took to move from Denver to Philadelphia, she came along, lost her job. She was making a ton of money as an executive in a big bank in Denver, came to Philadelphia, and they were just in the process of, you know, the checking account would go to a centralized place rather than being done in the bank there. And so what she did kind of disappeared. And so she lost her job and put up with my move. So all the support, and then supporting me when I was getting my doctorate. I got my doctorate a bit late, 24 years ago. Well, it doesn't sound late, but 24 years ago, I finally achieved a doctorate, and she was supporting me during that endeavor too, by feeding me and, you know, helping to financially support and all of that. So definitely number one, Joy Wierzbowski. Number two, professionally, Robert Pratt Jr.
Okay. All right.
And he's still my best friend. He lives about a mile away or so, and we visit each other like once a month. But once again, his knowledge, and maybe it is best for our profession. I see the people who are most successful being kind of generalist, like you. You know everything about neurophysiology, but you also know about the sciences. You're a wizard at math. I see taking apart filters and understanding things. You also take suggestions on a dielectric. I gave you a suggestion on a capacitor, and instead of being offended, you took it to heart and made that part of your lecture. So Rob was that sort of type of person, and he understood not just anatomy and neurophysiology. He would understand neuroscience all the way from the back to the beginning and beyond. He'd also those particle physics. He's an artist. He paints. He writes books and all of that. So as a generalist, he has all of this knowledge. And we have somewhat the same in neurophysiology, that we have to understand the surgical part of it, the surgery, the surgical techniques, what the anesthetist does, what the anesthesiologist does, the effects of all these different drugs and on our evoked potentials, on all the things that a patient, you know, is the patient diabetic? Does he have peripheral neuropathy? How about, you know, all these blood type of problems? Also, the vascular insufficiency. So we have to be very much a generalist, and that was Rob. Rob taught me to look deep into the well and to find out everything I possibly can, and so I owe that a debt to him. The third person is not a person. It's the societies I've been involved with. ASNM, in 1993, I presented some hip that was before H.B. Calder did. On his, he did a much better job, but all I did was say, you know, stimulate the perineal and you'll have better success. And after I gave my little spiel, guess what? Jack Cartouche came up to me, and Mark Stecker came up to me, not the other Mark, but these people gave me all sorts of encouragement, and it was just a wonderful bonding at that time with some of the best and brightest. And speaking of best and brightest, I spoke about the inventor of the Da Vinci robot before, Rick Sotava.
Mm-hmm.
What he told us was that our profession is probably the best thing that's happened in the medical profession in the last 20 years. We just don't know it yet. And so getting around the best and brightest in our field is the only way you can do that is to go to society meetings. You'll meet them in your own company. You probably have some brilliant people, but out there, you know, you'll meet someone like Chuck Yingling. You'll meet a Jack Hastings. You'll meet a Stan Skinner, and these people with their knowledge will just impress you and inspire you to be better than yourself and to take your career to a whole new level. So thank you to ASNM was the first, ACET was the second, ACNS the third, and prior to that, my audiology associates, you know, AAA and ASHA. Join your society. Go to the meetings, talk to people. Your most important a career step it might be that. So good luck, and thank you, James.
Yeah, very nice. I fully agree. I think societies, you have all kinds of people that have a lot of experience. They're very willing to share that experience, to teach. I found the same thing, Lawrence. When I started speaking at some of the society meetings, you were one of the individuals that came up and encouraged me to continue doing so. And I greatly appreciate that. So
you're a bright light in our profession. So thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you. I'll pay you later, by the way. So.
All right. Big bucks.
Thank you for taking the last 90 minutes of your time to talk to me and the NeuroPod community. Before I let you go, are there any parting thoughts that you have that you'd like to share with the NeuroPod community?
Yeah, other than just look in the mirror, you're the most important. Our profession is the most important thing to a patient having spinal injury to prevent. You know, the surgeon, of course, is number one, anesthesia, we're all a team. But when it comes down to actual monitoring, oh God, we are so important. So take care of yourselves. Make sure you take a good vacation and take care of yourselves and know that you're really special and very important to the lives of our patients.
I agree. Thank you, Lawrence. Appreciate you spending the last hour and a half of your time with me and with the community, and look forward to seeing you around at some of the society meetings coming up here shortly.
I'll be there, and take care of yourself, James. Thank you so much.
You too. Thank you. Take care.
NeuroPod content is intended for personal use and general information purposes only. NeuroPod cannot guarantee the accuracy of any statements made by guests or the sufficiency of the information. The opinions and views expressed by guests do not necessarily reflect or represent those of the host or producers. Such views are opinions of the guests and should not be used to inform appropriate patient care or for legal purposes. If you have specific medical concerns or questions, you should contact your healthcare provider. It is the listener's responsibility to confirm the accuracy of opinions and views before putting them into practice. NeuroPod disclaims any and all liability for injury or other damages for all claims which may result from the use of the information presented.